Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Teresa Wilkie. To begin our broadcast, host Jamie Jackson talks with Beverly Livingston, Director of Mothers of Incarcerated Sons and Daughters, and Stephanie Charles, a longtime member of that organization. They'll talk about their mission and Let the Truth Be Known, an upcoming event panel discussion about the systemic oppression of the incarcerated. Then in the second part of our program, host Margot Patterson will talk with Ken Novak, professor of criminology at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, specializing in policing in America and police behavior. He'll talk about his involvement in Kansas City's Smart Policing Initiative, which focuses on crime prevention in violent hotspots in our town. Stay tuned for the View from My Front Porch commentary in the middle of the broadcast and the 420 drug war news at the end of the broadcast. Now, here's Jamie and her guest.
Good morning. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. We're so excited to have with us two women who are with the Mothers of Incarcerated Sons and Daughters organization, Bev Livingston and also Stephanie. So my name is Jamie, and I want to talk to them a little bit about their organization, what it has been, what it does now, and about an event that they're sponsoring this coming Saturday at the Rockhurst Community Center that we are inviting everyone to attend. So let me start with either one of you, whoever would like to speak up first. And well, I would just like to give our listeners a little background on Mothers of Incarcerated Sons and Daughters. Bev, why don't you start?
All right. Good morning. I am Bev Livingston, the founder and chief advocate of Mothers of Incarcerated Sons and Daughters. We're known as MISD, M-I-S-D. And in 2009, we kind of came together as a brown bag lunch group that met at the Ad Hoc Group Against Crime on Thursday afternoons, I believe. And the table was just filled with women and people who were affected by incarceration, whether they had a loved one incarcerated, whether they were just in ministry or concerned about the influx of minority people getting excessively sentenced, being wrongfully convicted, and many, many other things as it related to incarceration. So having been a mother of a son who is in prison, who now we're over a decade of dealing with the system, had four different trials, mistrials, hung juries, and ended up with a conviction because the system that we're talking about that deals with criminal justice matters doesn't always play fair, and it isn't blind, as they say Lady Justice is blind. And so I saw things in the system that were very oppressive at the court level, the judicial decision-making, prosecution, as well as the arrest process. So if you don't get it right in the beginning, then the prison time and the reentry is affected by how it starts. And that's one of the reasons why we want to deal with in our Let the Truth Be Known series. This is our fourth edition, the systemic oppression within the criminal justice system. So MIST deals with public policy issues. We deal with advocacy, learning how to be our own best advocate, and therapeutic approaches to dealing with the various effects of incarceration, from depression, shame, the inability to even talk about it sometimes to your church members, because many of us who raised our children to be law-abiding citizens may end up dealing with the criminal justice system because of a bad choice that our loved ones have made. And once you get in there, it's hard to get out, and mothers don't have the power that we think we have when we're dealing with this system.
Okay, very good. And Stephanie, maybe you could tell us how you came to join with MIST and what your experience has been.
I joined MIST. My son at the time was in prison. He was with the feds, and of course he was a long way away. It's been a very good journey with MIST because it was very encouraging. I can remember when it came close time for him to come home, I started having anxiety attacks, and the women there encouraged me to do the best I can. And let me give you an example. A lot of times when he would call, I didn't want to talk because we didn't have anything to talk about. The prison was his life at that time, and that was something that I didn't want to hear about, I didn't want to deal with. And they let me know that it's okay, that I don't always have to answer the phone, and that he's going to be okay. And, of course, he was okay. So it's a very emotional time in your life. I was angry at him for going because I felt like that was something that did not need to happen. I had talked to him for years about doing the right thing. He ended up going anyway. It turned out that that was the best thing that could have happened in his life because it changed him completely, turned him around. He's home now. He's doing well. He's been out almost 3 years. He's working. He's been working since he's come home. And it was just a very learning experience in how to even deal with him. When he came home, there was a lot of emotions going on with him. I didn't realize that when they come home, that the prison has become their way of life. So when you come out here to deal with society, it is completely different. It was very emotional for him because he was used to, when you're in a place, you already know the rules and regulations where you are. That was for 6 years, and now you come home and you're free, but you're not free because emotionally he was still in bondage. But we worked through that, and he's doing well.
All right, great. And MIST helped step you through that process.
Absolutely.
All right. And, you know, I want to ask you about this event that you're planning. It's this Saturday at the Rockhurst Community Center, which is at 5401 Troost from 10 until noon on Saturday. And the public is invited. And you've got quite a panel gathered together to help people understand both the pros and cons of the criminal justice system right here. So tell me a little bit about how you gathered that panel together.
Well, we were looking for persons who have expert information and experience in the arrest process, the prison system, and the reentry system. So we have attorneys, two defense attorneys that will be dealing with questions and concerns as it relates to the court process. One is very experienced in post-conviction law. We have two legislators. We have lawmaker Senator David Haley from the Kansas State House, and we have Representative Brandon Ellington from the Missouri House of Representatives, and they both were kind of identified because of their involvement in sponsoring reforms for prisons and other kinds of legislation that affects people that we serve. We also have Family Court. We'll have a representative talking about some of the legal aspects as it relates to juveniles. We presented under the Let the Truth Be Known series, the bully law, last year, I think it was last year or year before last, and we talked about that new legislation that deals with children who are on the playground, on school buses, and in other areas where they are bullying other children, and they can become felons at elementary school age. So we wanted parents to be aware of that, not to encourage their kids to do bully type behaviors, because that's their start to the prison pipeline. So we are looking at having an array of people, Empower Missouri. We even have video conferenced in experts, and we are ready to answer questions and discuss how systemic oppression within the criminal justice system exists and what we can do, and maybe some action steps as to how we can be our own best advocates and teach our loved ones how to deal with oppressive situations, which we know exist, but some people really question whether or not systemic oppression exists in the criminal justice system and if it's deserving or if it's wrong. So we want to address that.
All right. And I was at that conference about the bullying. It was excellent. And I wonder, I know the concern is that there's already a concern before that bullying law passed of the, as you say, the school-to-prison pipeline. And I wonder, did the have there been any changes in the way that that bullying law was implemented, or what happened with that?
Well, I do believe that it's working for those who want to, and I'm sorry to put it like this, but want to kind of purge some of the students at the schools that are disruptive, causing problems. The zero tolerance that a lot of schools have adopted, considering charter schools and public schools and private schools, are in effect. I mean, you can't teach if you've got children who are disruptive, who are disrespectful, who are causing problems, and now there's a way that they are going to be dealt with, which is not the answer, but it gets them out of the school. And so, yes, I do believe that that is in full force, full effect. And I'm sure that, you know, what used to result in maybe a conference and a few days out of school is resulting in expulsions and just not dealing with it.
And could you talk about youth sentencing? Are there anything special that our listeners should know about how that works currently in our system?
Well, we're going to have a family court person there to talk about that. I am not as knowledgeable about the youth sentencing, except hearing things about the oppressive conditions in deciding what the outcomes will be for urban youth versus maybe a suburban youth situation. You can put same facts of the matter together, and oftentimes that urban youth is going to get a more extensive punishment and discipline than maybe some others. So that is something that will probably be addressed on Saturday.
Okay. And Stephanie, I know I would like to come back to the whole concept of reentry after when people are released from incarceration and they're having to make adjustments. Do you have anything? I know that you said that there was just issues, family issues that come up. But can you talk some more about how your what was the process? Because I know your son is doing quite well now. So what was the process in his reentry?
Well, when he came home, he had to go to the halfway house. He was there for 90 days. And then when he was released from the halfway house, he had to wear a monitor for 90 days. And so that kind of allowed him to slowly integrate into society without just being thrown out there, being free to just do, maybe end up doing things that he would not have intended on doing because he knew he was restricted. And I thought that worked well.
Okay. All right. And then during that time, he was able to look for a job. How did that work?
He found a job 2 weeks after he came home. He was working at a candle place in Kansas, and that lasted for a couple of months. And so I asked him, are you going to look for a job next week? He says, no, I'm going to find a job. So Tuesday, he had two offers. He started working at Casey Steak over in Kansas. So he's been there now for 2.5 years.
All right. All right, very good. Okay, so his is a success story,
yes.
Pretty much a success story. That's great. All right. Well, I saw on your information about the event you're having, you talked about truth, transparency, and protection under the law. So I wonder if we could elaborate on those concepts. What does the transparency? Let's start with transparency.
Well, there are a lot of deceptions that happen in various systems in our society, and when we look at the purposes of prisons, prisons have four major purposes. They are retribution, incapacitation, deterrence, and rehabilitation. Retribution means punishment for crimes against society. Depriving criminals of their freedom is a way of making them pay a debt to society for their crimes. Incapacitation refers to the removal of criminals from society so that they can no longer harm innocent people. And deterrence means the prevention of future crime. It is hoped that prisons provide warnings to people thinking about committing crimes and that the possibility of going to prison will discourage them from breaking the law. One of the things that we think, and we're not a pity party group of moms. We don't sit around and whine about, woe is me, and look what happened to my son, and look how long he's going to be gone for doing just this or just that. Any crime is wrong. And it's always right to be right and to do the right thing. So we fight to try to get people to be responsible for the behavior and accept the consequences and then deal with it and require to be treated fairly. And that is the struggle that we have in the criminal justice system, because it's been such a deceptive kind of oppressive system until your right to ask questions and to challenge things didn't really happen until now. Now you see kids taking it to the street. They want to have movements where they're getting truth and transparency in systems, from bearing arms to the recent border issues and the children and their families. So we're just asking for transparency as it relates to, if you say on Google, if we look up something about the DLC, we want to make sure that it's being implemented. We don't want to be visitors who come to visit our loved ones and find out you're on lockdown, and we can get alerts when we're catching trains and planes and other things about how, you know, it's been delayed or whatever. We could get word that the system is locked down, and so we don't have to make those 4-hour trips or 2-hour trips or spend that money lodging in a small town or area where our loved ones are housed. So there is not any friendly ways that the system tries to address the loved ones' needs of incarcerated people. And then they wonder why we show up, because they want to send us to Walmart because maybe our shirt has metal buttons or we wear some overalls or whatever. But then we may see someone from their community come in with overalls and it's okay. And that happened to me in Leavenworth. I went to visit my brother and I had on bib overalls that day, and because I wear Western looks and I love just being comfortable and casual. And I saw a gentleman come in with bibs on, and he went right through the metal detector that basically beeped, and they let him in. And I thought, I know my bibs are just like his bibs. Mm-hmm. But yet they told me I need to go to Walmart and get something different to wear, mm-hmm. something that doesn't have all those fasteners and, mm-hmm. and all that. Mm-hmm. So some of it is blatant, and we can, you know, see that we're being treated differently. And sometimes it could be your turn to be refused a visit or a non-contact visit. All kinds of things happen. So visiting is not a pleasant occasion for many of us, because we never know what to expect. And for a mother to be treated the way we have been treated during visits is just appalling, and it's embarrassing, and it's hurtful, but it's nothing that we can do about it at that time. Mm-hmm. So we just come together to try to figure out ways. Who do we need to write? Who do we need to communicate? What do we need to do? And we try to inform, empower, and help people to become their own best advocate in this system.
Okay. And so, for example, on the visitor's policy, the policy is posted somewhere, like online, but that doesn't necessarily cover all the issues.
It's like one day it's in, you know, it's enforced. The next day, that policy may not be the policy. It just kind of depends on who's running the visitation desk, how they feel that day, and just whose turn it is to be, you know, hassled and uh-huh. and day made miserable. It's really unfortunate, because we are aware of the rules. And when someone goes to a facility and there's new rules or something posted, we're informed about it, and we try to be, you know, in accordance to whatever it is, it's, you know, that's expected of us. But uh-huh. sometimes the rules change and we don't know about it.
Right. So I wonder, are there any specific steps that your group has taken to try and make things a little better for people visiting their loved ones or for dealing with their loved ones? What?
Well, as we learn new information, of course, we make that available. So sharing knowledge and educating each other is one of the things that we do.
That's a lot.
Yes. It is. Uh-huh. And then another thing, I believe in always going to the top. Go to management. Go to the directors. And the DOC was invited to come this Saturday so that they would have a voice at the table so that it wouldn't seem like we were just there to beat up on them. And we got a decline because they've just got so much going on right now. And as you know, there are facilities that are still in lockdown, and there are corrections officers who are quitting their jobs. And so they're short of staff. They've got management issues. They've got other kind of funding issues. And it's just a mess. And so what happens is we're somewhat mistreated and our loved ones are oppressed because they don't have it together. And I'm just going to put it out there like that, because if something is well managed and if it's transparent and if it's giving people their civil rights and treating people the way that they should be treated, some of the things that happen and the uprisings and the unfairness and the oppressive conditions would not exist.
Right, and I was at your recent missed meeting, and I was impressed by someone who said that she keeps a log of all of her contacts with the prison, whether it's an attempt to visit or a letter she sends to the head of the prison or anything. She keeps a log of it, so she has a record of her attempts to get her loved ones' rights acknowledged. So I think that's great. And then the group is, she shared that with the group, and she was sharing that with somebody else to encourage her to do the same thing. So I think your group is wonderful. I commend you for your work, and I know you're helping a lot of people. Let's remind our listeners that there's going to be an event at the Rockhurst Community Center this Saturday, June 30th, from 10 until noon. And the Rockhurst Community Center is at 5401 Troost. So 5401 Troost, and it's from 10 until noon. Okay, tell me about your experience with wrongful convictions. I know you must have a lot of experience with people who have had wrongful convictions.
I know that the day has come when we're all hearing on the news about people being released because they were found innocent. After 30 years, I think that, you know, it's about time that some people are released. And just to imagine how a person feels who day after day, year after year, they are incarcerated for something that they did not do, it's a horrible experience. I applaud the Midwest Innocence Project and other efforts that really fight to free people who are wrongfully convicted. However, there are still people caught in that system of wrongful conviction, such as our own Ricky Kidd. Ricky Kidd has practically crossed every T, had every I dotted for him to prove his innocence, and he just can't seem to get that justice at the end of the journey. So I do know that wrongful convictions are now being recognized and actions are being taken, but it's just not fast enough. It's not enough, but have to start someplace, and I am thankful for people who are aware that there are some people incarcerated that don't deserve to be.
Right. All right. And I'm just going to throw out a personal observation I've made, and that is whether you were wrongfully convicted or you were serving time for something that you did, people don't realize that if you're in prison for a long time, then you don't have a work record. You don't have, and so it affects your ability to collect Social Security when you reach old age. You might not get it because you haven't contributed into the Social Security system. So that kind of safety net is not available to you. And of course, there are other ways in which when you get out that it's difficult to find housing and find employment. So these are all things that the MISD people are helping mothers of incarcerated and recently incarcerated sons and daughters to deal with the multiple problems that face people during incarceration and on their release. So is there any last word that you'd like to offer our listeners? How about you, Stephanie? Do you have anything you want to add?
We need more people to come out and help us with this fight.
Right.
It affects everybody because these young people, doesn't matter what age they are, they're going to eventually, most of them eventually are going to come home, and they're going to need a safety net in order to keep from reoffending.
Right, right.
Absolutely. And I want to say that we spend a lot of time, you know, talking about the system and how messed up it is and woe is me in terms of once you get caught up in it. But I would like to just say that we are totally against people breaking laws, committing crimes, and actually making choices that land them in a system of incarceration. If people would just be law-abiding, do the right thing, don't take those chances, make good choices, listen to your parents, and just do the right thing, is always right to do the right thing, then you don't have to worry about these kinds of issues. You don't have to worry about someone else telling you what to do, when to do it, and how to do it. However, I know people are sometimes at the wrong place at the wrong time and get caught up. But there are some career criminals. There are 77% of released prisoners that are rearrested within 5 years. There are some people who just don't want to play by the rules. So we just want to say we're not encouraging it.
Right. Thank you for that. And, of course, we want to remind our listeners that most of the people who are in prison today are going to be released eventually. So we want to support them in their reentry process. So thank you very much, women, for coming
thank
and
you.
Talking to us about your event this Saturday, June 30th.
This is Jeff Humfeld with the view from my front porch. Many here in Kansas City area and across the nation have been out in force protesting the immoral policy of separating children from their parents as they come to our borders seeking asylum. This policy is wrong in so many ways. It violates international treaties and norms on how asylum seekers are to be treated and processed. And the rhetoric used to vilify anyone showing up at our southern border has been used by despots for ages. The claim of asylum has been negated and replaced by a criminal process for trespassing. The administration's claim that it is a law passed by Democrats has been shown to be untrue and is a smokescreen for their policy. The truth is even more disturbing, because we have been here before. What looks like one big incompetent mess wrapped up in bad policy is actually a plan to negate the law. A 1997 class action lawsuit resulted in what was called the Flores Settlement, requiring the release of unaccompanied children under 18 to parents, relatives, or other guardians. In 2015, that ruling was amended to include children coming with one or both parents. The Trump administration's plan was to get around that ruling by forcing a public demand that the children be kept with their parents, who of course are in custody under criminal charges. The Obama administration also tried to keep the children detained with their parents, but a 2016 ruling required release of the children. However, it did not rule on whether the parents had to be released or not. That takes us back to the border and those who are seeking asylum. They are not entering the U.S. illegally. They are coming to our border to apply for asylum from violence and threats faced in their home country. The policy of the Trump administration is to skip past the asylum process and charge those asylum seekers with crossing the border illegally, taking them directly to a criminal process and detaining them indefinitely until they are deported. This indefinite incarceration of parent and child is what the administration wanted. This policy and maneuvering will not stand as the policy is brought back into court and ruled on once again. My hope is that this indignation over the separation of children on the border, the tent cities, and the cruel treatment some of these children received will not die away. What I would like to see is education of the public about the separation of parents and children in this country due to an unjust criminal justice system, the demand for bodies by the prison industrial complex, and the recognition of the penal slavery clause in the U.S. Constitution. We need to understand that the torture inflicted by the U.S. in the name of the war on terror and the war on drugs that brings the asylum seekers to our borders was developed inside the prisons and jails of this country. I hope the outrage over the drugging of these immigrant children puts a spotlight on the drug experiments on Native children in detention in this country, that there is a recognition of the long-term emotional trauma inflicted on these families, and understanding that this has been going on for decade upon decade in the families of the incarcerated in this country. Don't get me wrong. I am grateful for the surge of concern and activism around these families on our borders. I am pleading with those of you on the street today to bring that outrage and focus it within your own communities. We must look to the roots and source, not just the most obvious symptoms. This is Jeff Humfeld, and that is The View from My Front Porch. It is mine and mine alone, not necessarily that of KKFI or even Jaws of Justice Radio. Please, get out on your own front porch and look around.
This is Margo Patterson with Jaws of Justice Radio. My guest today is Professor Ken Novak from the Department of Criminal Justice and Criminology at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Professor Novak specializes in policing in America and police behavior and has been involved in various policing initiatives here in Kansas City, the No Violence Alliance, which seeks to reduce gun violence, and the Kansas City Smart Policing Initiative. One of his key areas of interest is evidence-based policing. I'm hoping we'll get a chance to talk about all of these different aspects of his work. But first, a question about two recent police killings in Kansas City on June 15th. Three people were killed that day. One was 29-year-old Ashley Fulkerson, a woman who had a sword, and then was subsequently killed by police. And then two men in Barney Ellis Plaza downtown fighting over a golf cart. Tim Mosley and Robert White were also killed by police. What's your impression of those incidents?
Well, first, thank you for having me. Those incidents are largely examples of when the police are using force in the face of some type of resistance. And, you know, one of the things we need to remember is that the police are permitted to use force up to and including lethal force when there is a credible threat to life or serious bodily injury. And those are the legal parameters for which they operate within. And one of the things that we're currently doing now as we try to digest what happened and whatnot is we're looking at those incidents with 20/20 hindsight. We're trying to understand under that circumstance, those circumstances, was force appropriate? Was it necessary? What led up to it? Officers at the scene don't have the benefit of 20/20 hindsight. And so it's always going to be a bit of a complicated conversation trying to understand the reasonable officer at the scene compared to what we know as we unpack it later in a community conversation.
How much do you think police today are conscious of public criticism and responding to it?
Oh, I think they're extremely conscious of public criticism. And if they're not, they should absolutely be so, because part of the point is that in a democratic society, I'm going to get real big picture on you here, in a democratic society, one of the principles is that we let the police police us. And because of that, we, the public, get to have influence on what that looks like. And when the police are criticized or questioned, that's part of the natural process within democratic policing. I can tell you that the police are absolutely, the officers that I speak to are absolutely conscious of community perception and how their actions are being interpreted. And incidents like these that you brought up, they're absolutely conscious of how the public perceives use of force.
Well, how do you change, or how do you translate increased and increasing public concern about the excessive force of police, excessive use of force by police, into actually change behavior? Because I think it's a perception of many in the public that these officer-involved shootings continue, that they are unwarranted, really without any possible excuse. And so the perception of police violence seems to, in the public, my perception is it gets worse and worse, and yet police behavior doesn't really seem to be changing that much. Is that true or no?
I'm not sure if we know that's true. I do know that in recent years, police, all behavior, but police responses and their behaviors have become far more visible than they were 5-10 years ago. With the advent of cell phone cameras and with, increasingly police departments are moving towards body-worn cameras, it's such a ever-present component of the police-public interaction that it may not be that police use of force is any different than it used to be. In fact, looking at the FBI's numbers, it tends to go down. It has been going down for decades. I think we're just a lot more aware, and we see it a lot more because of the ever-present camera that people have.
When I first spoke to you, you were at a conference of the American Society of Evidence-Based Policing, and you mentioned that's a key research interest of yours. Could you explain what is evidence-based policing?
Sure. Evidence-based policing is an approach that encourages police departments to adopt strategies and tactics and training that have demonstrated to have the best research evidence on what works. So when it comes to police behavior and priorities and strategies, historically the police, what they did in, on the street was largely based on culture and craft. It's the way we've always done it. This type of strategy worked here, so it's going to work there. What the evidence-based policing strategy does is tries to infuse research evidence on what works, what doesn't, and what's promising. And so when you can find that overlap between police culture and craft and strategies that they currently use, as well as those strategies that have demonstrated in other jurisdictions, in other types of crimes, over repeated trials, those strategies that work the best should be the ones that receive the highest priority when it comes to funding and adoption on the street.
Can you give us some examples of what is best practice?
Sure. I'll give you a couple different examples. One of the things that we've recognized for a long time is that crime is highly concentrated. Crime is concentrated amongst small groups of individuals, both as suspects, offenders, as well as victims. Victimization is highly concentrated amongst small groups of individuals. And we've also seen that crime tends to be concentrated geographically. Small segments of the city tend to have a disproportionate amount of crime and problems. And so one evidence-based strategy that has been deployed over the last several decades, and they're currently doing it here in Kansas City, is called hotspot policing. What hotspot policing does is uses crime information and internal data that the police have on crimes and calls for service and highlight only those areas that have the greatest concentration of crime. And then from that, after you've identified small pockets, usually only about a quarter mile, square mile, not an entire community, but like a quarter mile series of blocks and intersections, then the strategy becomes, why is crime driven here? Why is this a persistent problem? And what types of root causes are occurring here that attract people to be victimized or offend in these areas. That's a very efficient way to use resources by concentrating on only the very small hotspots. And the research evidence has demonstrated over years hotspot policing is one of those best practices.
In terms of trying to implement such, you know, evidence-based best practices, how receptive are police departments in general to evidence?
It varies. And, you know, one of the things that I think we had talked about previously, when we talk about the police, we think about it as if they're a single entity. The reality of the matter is that there's about 18,000 police departments across the country. So when you try to understand how receptive are the police, some police departments are more progressive and receptive to trying new things, trying different innovations. And Kansas City is one of those departments that has historically been open to innovation and trying things new. What we found is that when the evidence-based practice coincides with the more it coincides with officers' expectations and a lot of times the things that they're doing already, it becomes a lot easier to try to implement that strategy in those cities. It's when we start to go a farther astray from the traditional law enforcement model that implementation becomes a little bit more difficult. That's why hotspot policing is one of those strategies that tend to be a little bit easier to implement, because cops know that that crime is concentrated in small areas, and cops know that not everybody is equal likely to be a victim or an offender. So that makes it a little bit easier to innovate, implement things like that.
This is Margot Patterson on Jaws of Justice Radio, and if you're just tuning in, I'm talking to Dr. Ken Novak, a professor of criminology and criminal justice at UMKC. Dr. Novak, I read that the first police department in America was established in Boston in 1838. I'm curious, how have police norms changed over the years since the first police departments were implemented and established?
Wow,
that's a huge question. If you were to confine it to the last 20 well, to 30 years, that would be...
Yeah, and you know, in the 1830s, when Boston and New York and Philadelphia, those early industrial cities that started to implement policing, you know, policing was created in America largely out of necessity of having urban areas where during the Industrial Revolution, when you know, people from different societies and cultures and norms had to get along with each other. And so the police were created as a formal way to try to manage how people interact with each other. It's evolved. Policing has evolved tremendously over the last two centuries, simply because of technology. But a lot of times that, you know, policing has ebbed and flowed in terms of how close the police are with the community that they serve.
Are there particular, I heard a lot in recent years about, was it broken windows policing? You mentioned hotspot policing. Is that the sort of current model that's popular in policing? Are there other models out there? Are they constantly changing or shifting?
Yeah, and you bring up broken windows. And in recent years, the more we learn about how broken windows works, the less excited policymakers are about it. To summarize broken windows, the idea is that if there is social or physical disorder in a neighborhood that is left unkept, then more violence will occur. So dilapidated buildings, burnt out cars, kids hanging out on the street, those types of incivilities encourage more serious criminal activity to occur. So what do? You clean up the streets. You get those kids off the street. You reduce the numbers of, you know, physical disorders and the broken buildings and whatnot. And it really encouraged a zero tolerance towards crime approach. There had been, broken windows has demonstrated to work in some jurisdictions, New York City being one of them. The problem with broken windows that we've learned over time is that, one, once you start it, you really can't stop. Because if you're a heavy police presence of zero tolerance in a neighborhood, once they take their foot off the gas and reduce the amount of law enforcement, then those problems tend to reoccur. So once you start it, you really can't stop. And then two, citizens start to feel like the police are an occupying force and don't really appreciate the good folk, don't really appreciate the occupying force, heavy-handed law enforcement. And so what ends up happening is that the public starts to distrust the police, and the police start to lose legitimacy in the eyes of the public because they're so heavy-handed in law enforcement. So that's one of the things that we've learned with broken windows over time, is that, yeah, it can work in the short term, but the cost is you lose the relationship that you have with the community.
There's been a lot of talk about the militarization of the police, and what you say about broken windows seems to suggest, if it doesn't come out of that, it sort of parallels that. Is that correct, do you think, or do you think the militarization of the police and broken windows sort of came about through two separate but parallel tracks?
They probably came across in two parallel and separate tracks, but they encouraged each other. So, like, the increased militarization of the police we've seen since the 1990s in particular, a lot of it was due to the federal 1033 program. I think I got that correct. The 1033 program was a way that when the military had to decommission or get rid of a lot of their military, you know, light armored tanks and things like that, weaponry, they decommissioned it and sold it to police departments at a very cheap price. And that was largely because of the Gulf War. We no longer needed those equipment, or they were being replaced by newer stuff. So the old stuff gets sold to who? Who's your target audience to buy decommissioned military equipment? The police are a logical one. So we saw with broken windows an increased acceptance of heavy-handed law enforcement, coupled with new military devices that are becoming more available to police. And those two things tend to go hand in glove a little bit.
Well, I know the Obama administration sort of slowed down the sale of military vehicles and military equipment to the police, and I think my understanding is the Trump administration has reversed that. Do you think police departments themselves are becoming more suspicious or questioning about the use of military equipment and military tactics in policing?
I think that the police being they're a paramilitary industry. They were born out of the military and the law. So it's always going to have a little bit of overlap between the two. But I think what we've seen, and what I think progressive police leaders have seen, is that having the trust and faith and legitimacy of the public is far more important, is a far more important component of policing than a lot of this heavy-handed law enforcement. So there are absolutely times when militaristic types of equipment may be necessary and very appropriate in law enforcement. But the more you have trust of the public, and the more the public views the police as legitimate, the less likely you're going to have to use or need those military items. It becomes a really good question of how much the public feels that the militarization of police is appropriate. Getting back to our conversation about democratic policing, the way the police look, the way the police act, should be a reflection of the society in which it serves.
In terms of the public feeling that they have a sense of control over the police, obviously you can have the public protests, but how do you translate public dissatisfaction with policing into actually police change? Is that just a question of budgets, giving police, you know, fewer resources, but I imagine that might seem a sort of blunt instrument to deal with the mm-hmm. problem. So I'm kind of interested in, if we see a great deal of public dissatisfaction, they're feeling they're dissatisfied, but nothing is changing. What are the ways that the public, what strategies can the public take to actually see real change?
And protests are one example of that, a rather extreme example sometimes. But since the police are an inherently local function, a lot of the community distrust or dissatisfaction with the police can be translated through local politicians. And I think that's really getting involved in local politics and influencing local politics to shape the police is a more effective, probably, way than protests.
We just have one minute left before we have to go off the air. Are there other encouraging reforms that you see happening or new strategies on the part of police that you see developing?
Yeah, especially since the events in Ferguson in 2014, which was kind of a watershed moment in at least recent policing history, recognizing that de-escalation tactics being used by the police has become increasingly important. Recognizing that, and that now the police are being trained in a lot more frequent manner of how to de-escalate a scenario before it escalates to violence or use of force. And so we've seen that recently, that the police are paying a lot more attention to trying to determine how to de-escalate scenarios to reduce that conflict between itself and the public.
I've been talking to Dr. Ken Novak, a criminologist at UMKC. Dr. Novak, thank you so much for being here with us today. And next is the 420 Drug War News.
It's the 420 Drug War News, and this is part of my discussion with San Ho Tree of the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. What people need to understand is what's going on in Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador. The gangs are taking over many of the smaller cities, the villages, and running them as if they were, you know, the law enforcement themselves, and demanding that they, the kids join the gangs and help out in that effort.
Some gangs do get involved in narcotics trafficking, but a lot of them are going, you know, the old-fashioned means of raising money, which is extortion, you know, production money, that sort of thing, and theft and other ways, and sex trafficking, human trafficking, that sort of thing. But it is true that these kids are faced with, and these parents of kids are faced with an untenable choice. You know, they tell you they're going to join the gang or they're going to kill you. And if you're a woman, you'll submit to them sexually or they'll also kill you. And they can get away with it because there's incredibly high levels of impunity, which was not helped by the Trump administration recognizing fraudulent elections in places like Guatemala, where you know they're fine with corruption as long as the oligarchs stay in power. And so we're created in many ways this hellhole. It also began, let's be very, very clear about this, MS-13 originated as a U.S. street gang in Los Angeles, 13th Street Gang. And it's our gang deportation policies that began under Clinton, essentially, where we began to escalate this sort of thing, and continued under Bush and under Obama, and hugely under Trump, where they deport a lot of these kids who are from Central America back to their home country of origin if they're in any way even alleged to be involved with a gang. And these people, very often these kids, have no memory of these home countries. Some of them don't even speak the language, but they're being forced back on a one-way ticket. And guess who's waiting for them at the airport? Gang members. So we helped turn a localized regional problem into a transnational criminal organization. We've given them strong footholds in both societies, both ends of this problem now. And it's no wonder that they've become as strong as they have.
The cartels have branched out in many instances, you know, not necessarily given up the drug trade, but have branched out into extortion and other criminal activities as well. Am I right there, sir?
Yeah, and a lot of that is thanks to President Calderon's war on drugs, which, you know, was so ill-conceived that he showed and demonstrated to criminal organizations, not only can you get away with drug trafficking, but you can get away with anything, with impunity.
Again, that was San Ho Tree of the Institute for Policy Studies, and I am Dean at drugtruth.net.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. You can always listen to us live and find our podcasts on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. This is Jamie reminding you our outro music is Better Man from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Cowtown Conversations on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Monday Morning Medicine Show with Dr. Mike, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day south of the border with Fiesta Musical, Compartiendo Familia, and Compartiendo en Noche.